Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, everybody. This is Rabbi Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio and Podcast. These shows represent a desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. And again, you can comment or give us suggestions. You can leave actually a voicemail if you want a suggestion on our website, jewishsacredaging.com. You can go to the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page and the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. Lots of opportunities to let your voices and suggestions be known. Our first segment guest today, standing by through the magic of technology, Rabbi Michelle Medwin. Rabbi Medwin, welcome to Jewish Sacred Aging Radio and Podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay, other than a little laryngitis.
Yeah, I know. So we'll try to keep the answers short.
That's okay.
Rabbi Medwin, nice to see you. Rabbi Medwin is, you're in upstate, you're in New York, in the southern tier of New York, right?
Right, Binghamton and Monticello.
And I was also in private practice dealing with issues related to Alzheimer's, and we're going to talk specifically about Rabbi Medwin's new book, Alzheimer's Family, subtitled Emotional and Spiritual Tools for Coping, recently published, available on Amazon, and it's called Chester Woods Press out of Binghamton, New York, Alzheimer's Family's Emotional and Spiritual Tools for Coping. So, Michelle, lots to talk about, unpack. This book, this genesis of this project, comes from a personal story, as many of these situations do. Can you just share with us a little bit the motivation for writing this book?
Sure. My dad had Alzheimer's for 10 years. My mom was his caregiver for those 10 years. It was just really hard to watch him deteriorate and her deteriorate as she was taking care of him. And then I was getting the DMIN program degree, and we had to come up with a thesis to work on, and I decided to write about Alzheimer's families to research ways for myself, but also help everyone else that I could make the process easier and more meaningful.
You write in the book that On page 69, you write, "As a rabbi, my theological worldview was challenged when my father developed Alzheimer's dementia until I opened my heart and soul to alternative ways of thinking." Could you walk us through, it's a very interesting statement on the part of a rabbi that this situation with dad challenged your, quote, theological worldview. What did you mean by that?
Well, there's a basic worldview that, you know, good people are rewarded and bad people are punished. I sort of had moved away from that anyway, but he was my father who was there physically, but really wasn't himself. And I believe in the soul, and so I was trying to understand his Alzheimer's in the context of having a soul. I had done a lot of research in spirituality and the soul and Kabbalah. And I remembered the morning blessing that you say, thanking God when you wake up for giving you your life back, because it was believed that when you slept, your soul went to visit God for a while. And I also know that Kabbalah talks about different parts of the soul. So I sort of put that all together and imagined my dad when he'd have moments he was very coherent. And then he had moments where he was just off somewhere and didn't really know what was going on. So instead of thinking he lost his mind, I try to look at it from the point of view that that part of his soul that represents who he is as a person was off visiting God for a while. So that I didn't feel like he lost his mind. I just felt he was hanging out with God. And that just made me feel more comforted and also feel that that soul was still there and had value.
You know, you mentioned, and we'll get to some of the liturgy and ritual stuff in a minute because it's fascinating, and you did a really magnificent job in the book on this. But I know we've talked before, and the idea of, you know, where does this soul go? And I remember dealing with situations both professionally and also personally with my own mom, with the idea that perhaps that essence of this human being is in another level of reality or dimension that we in our sphere of reality cannot comprehend. So is that, you know, when you put it very poetically, that in my dad's soul was off visiting God, and that essence of him wasn't there. His body was there, but his life essence, his soul was off in another reality with God. It's a very interesting way of looking at it. And I think a very beautiful way of looking at it. You write in the book also, Michelle, a little bit about the Buberian I, thou, I, it relationship or potential for relationship. How do you relate that? I guess it flows really from what you just were just talking about. How do you relate that to dealing with an individual dealing with Alzheimer's between the I, it, and the I, thou? Could you just expand on that a little bit? Because I think it flows
from
what you were just talking about, the soul.
Before the person develops Alzheimer's, if it's a close relative, you should have what they call an I, thou relationship. It's a special relationship. You connect to each other. You care about each other, you help each other out. And as the person slowly seems to disappear into the dementia land, whatever that is, you lose that I-thou connection, and it almost becomes an I-it connection. I-it connection, the way I describe it, is when you go to the store and you're checking out, you have an I-it relationship with the cashier. They have a function, but there's no personal relationship. Unless they or you say, have a nice day, and you smile at them, then it turns it more into an I-thou. And the biggest challenge I had was not forgetting that there was a thou in there, because it was so easy when you had to deal with the practical challenges of Alzheimer's and my father's behavior, which was not always pleasant. I had to work really hard to remember there still is an I-thou relationship in there somewhere.
So This leads you to the approach of you talk about at the end of the book, you have in this very interesting appendix of it, really into the book, about 10 absolutes, sort of like 10 commandments of communication with somebody dealing with Alzheimer's dementia, and that really is something that most people don't really get to understand. Can you walk us through some of those 10 commandments or 10 absolutes, I think you call it, on a scale of,
right,
of basically learning how to approach, work with, understand, and be empathic to a person dealing with dementia?
Right. And I do want to say a lot of this I got from a man called... who runs a Facebook page, Rick, I'm drawing a blank on his last name right now, Rick, I'll have to look it up, it's in the book. he had early onset Alzheimer's.
Right.
I have a little Alzheimer's, not remembering his name.
Rick Felt.
And he was able to post and describe what he felt like. Mm-hmm. So he went through some of these things. Because I wish I had written this book earlier on in my father's disease. I think by the time I wrote it, he was near the end or had already passed on, although my mother-in-law currently has Alzheimer's, and knowing the things I know now have been very helpful. But there are things I did looking back and I wish I had done differently. When you're in the throes of work dealing with someone with Alzheimer's, it's very easy to lose your patience and get frustrated. You sort of expect them to do what they always did, even though they can't do it, and you think they're doing it on purpose or they're not trying hard enough. So the step is about all these nevers that we tend to do. One of them is to never argue, instead agree. And I'll share with you a personal story with that. I had been an optometrist, an eye doctor, before I became a rabbi. And my sister is a physician. And so one day I went to visit my dad, and he said, "How is your practice doing?" So I thought to myself, well, either he thinks I'm still an optometrist and not a rabbi, or he thinks I'm my sister. And so I said, no, Dad, I don't have a practice anymore. I'm a rabbi now. Do you remember? And that was really the wrong thing to do. There, for them, the reality is what's their reality, and there really was no point having to correct that fact. So instead of arguing, I should have said, thank you, Dad, my practice is doing fine.
Mm-hmm.
There's no point to force someone in the Alzheimer's realm to have to deal with actual facts. There's no meaning in it for them. And it just creates tension.
Some of these 10 absolutes of communicating, you mentioned never argue, instead agree. You write, never reason, instead divert. Never shame, instead distract. What does that mean, never shame, distract?
I can make it personal again. My father, we would try to go out when we went to visit. I didn't live in town, and so we tried to take them out to give my mother a break. And he was very agitated by any noise. So he would start screaming and yelling. And it was easy, certainly for some family members, to sort of say, Dad, just be quiet. Stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But that didn't help. And so another way would be to distract him or... he had trouble talking with background noise, so maybe make the conversation easier. People with Alzheimer's do things. Part of it is they lose their filters. So I remember my dad in the dining room of where they live in assisted living, would make comments out loud like, boy, that person is so tall, and some other comments which I won't repeat. But instead of shaming him, saying, how could you say that? That's a horrible thing to say. Then the goal is to just change the conversation and not focus on it.
Does this have something to do with ultimately when you take back all the masks and the facades and the conventions, that it really does get back down to the basic Jewish value of the dignity of a human being? That even in the situation with you're describing with your dad, you don't do anything to riff on this passage in Kiddushin that really brings shame or dishonor or takes away the dignity of a human being, even in these extremist circumstances, that human being is still in the image and you can't deny the dignity. I mean, I think that seems to be in a Jewish value perspective underneath this absolute about never shame, instead distract. One of the other things is also, because we've all been guilty of this, never say remember, instead reminisce.
Right.
So that basically says, remember when we used to do this, or do you remember when you did that? Then how do you translate that into the concept of reminiscing?
By sharing yourself, saying, I remember there was a time when we went to the store together. Saying, do you remember? Because they don't, and they feel stupid, ignorant, embarrassed. So reminiscing to me is more of a, do you remember we went to the beach together? That was a fun time we had. Instead of, do you remember? Because they don't. And then they feel bad.
We've had some people on before who are Dale, Rabbi Friedman, who works also extensively with this population, other individuals who manage memory care units, et cetera. And a lot of the conversation seems to be, and I work with the Alzheimer's Association here in southeastern, in the Delaware Valley, this ongoing research about the use of smells and odors and music as a way of communicating, especially music. Which seems to be a very, very powerful tool with individuals dealing with Alzheimer's. So have you had experience with this? And also in your counseling now, in your professional practice, do you see this being used more and more?
Absolutely. I remember my parents were very devoted synagogue attenders. And my mother would try to take him to synagogue. And he remembered the music. He may not have known what was going on, what the rabbi was saying, the meaning of the sermon. When he heard the music, it comes from a different part of your brain.
Right.
my dad would walk around singing, Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. And that became known at the facility for that. And music, they would have, you know, entertainment come in, and they would play oldies. And he just turned him to another person. He became happy and smiling and singing along. So that part of your brain that remembers music left much beyond the actual memory of details.
We're speaking with Rabbi Michelle Medwin about her brand new book, Alzheimer's Families, Emotional and Spiritual Tools for Coping, and her professional practice up in the southern tier of New York State dealing with this. You write extensively in the middle of the book, Michelle, about the power and the concept and the need for hope. Could you talk to me a little bit about that? Because those of us who've dealt with this in some way, shape, or form, there are times when hope seems to disappear.
Right. And with other diseases, even cancer, as traumatic as it can be, especially now, many people survive cancer. So there's always hope and there's always one more thing to try. You know, eventually it may not be true. When my dad got the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, I knew that was it. There was no hope that he would get better. No hope at all. So there's a study that I read about, because people need to live with hope. And they interviewed different caregivers, and what they said is they changed their concept of hope. Hope became a day-to-day thing, and it would be things like, I hope today will be easier than yesterday. I hope I can get through the day. I hope that he will enjoy this thing that we're trying to do. So the hope became very small, very immediate, and very short, but people still needed to hope for something. Otherwise, they would despair.
So it becomes a very targeted hope, if I can use that phrase, you know,
the
immediacy.
What do you hope for tomorrow?
Instead,
what do you hope for down the road?
You've spent a significant amount of time, and there's a lot of really wonderful inclusions in the book dealing with prayer and ritual. And so I want to, if I can, just talk to you a little bit about that. You write in one of the sections of the book, I think the chapter is called The Spiritual Understanding. You reference a book called Seven Prayers That Can Change Your Life, and one of them is dealing with the priestly benediction, may the Lord bless you and keep you, etc., which is known cross-denominationally. And you place this priestly benediction from the Book of Numbers in the context of your spiritual understanding of dealing with Alzheimer's. How does this prayer, may God bless you and keep you, may God's face be, you know, shine upon you, and may you, you know, give you peace. How does this prayer relate to dealing with your subject of Alzheimer's and dementia?
I think it helps change your perspective. One of the hardest things, and as I interviewed different families, the families that had the hardest time was when the other spouse was the caregiver. So the adult children would not only see one parent deteriorating in memory, but the other parent deteriorating in health, because it was such a stress to take care of the person with Alzheimer's. And it was easy to get angry and mad at the behaviors. But if you could stop and recite this prayer to your loved one with Alzheimer's, all of a sudden just puts it in a different perspective. You're asking God to bless them and bring peace to them. And it helps change that cycle of resentment and anger into one of more of a peace and maybe more empathy.
Well, the blessing that you quote from this book, it's very, very powerful. May the one, meaning God, may the one bless you and safeguard you. May the one illuminate your way and be gracious to you. May the one raise up in your direction to encourage you and give you a sense of wholeness and peace. And you use this in the context of blessing an individual with Alzheimer's, correct?
Yes.
And I guess
it can also work for the caregiver.
Well, yeah, because Go ahead.
No, because the caregiver needs a lot of support. And offering a blessing to the caregiver of God, looking over them and watching them and being with them and helping them through, can also give spiritual support to the caregiver as well as the patient.
So let's talk a little bit about the caregiver, because in every context that we talk about dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's, it always comes back not only to the individual, but to the caregiver and the stress and strain of the caregiver. One of the things I did want to ask you is in the back of the book, you have this appendix to caregiver burden scales, caregiver grief survey. What is this? Why did you include this in the book? Talk to me about this.
Okay. One of the things that a therapist who is not really well versed in Alzheimer's, if a caregiver, people sometimes caregivers feel, they call it depressed. They go to the therapist. This happened to my mom, and he gave her antidepressants. But really, what's happening is it's not depression; it's mourning. People are mourning the losses along the way, and they're slow, and so they're not so obvious like a death, but they're mourning the loss of companionship, the loss of conversation, the loss of someone being able to do things around the house that used to do things. And people, it seemed like people did much better when they were counseled for loss and grief rather than depression. Because while they both have this symptom of sadness in common, someone who's depressed doesn't want to get out of bed, can't function, can't think, can't plan. And that's the opposite of a caregiver. They get out of bed, they have to plan, they have to do. And so the burden, the scale was put in there to help people figure out where they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much is this affecting them, and maybe give them some insights into how they feel. Because it also compares the grief. And then just be able to focus on grief more than the depression.
Well, the scale, again, this is in the back of the book, on an appendix,
right,
talks a lot about feelings. You know, how do you feel when, or how do you feel that, you know, A, B, or C? And it's a sliding scale, obviously, that talks about the stresses and strains of caregiving, and which, as you know, and you probably see in your counseling with individuals, that's a major concern, and caregiver burnout, because as you point out from in the book and every piece of literature that's been written about this, this is not a disease that, you know, can last a year or two. We all know situations of where a caregiver or somebody with Alzheimer's can last, you know, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. It's a real life changing, shattering, emerging, and also spiritually challenging moment. What in your counseling with caregivers, what's the piece of advice that you try to get to them most of all? What are those one or two things that you constantly stress in dealing with caregivers, with people who are caregivers?
Right. Well, one of the things research shows that is most helpful is to finally accept it, because a lot of people are in denial. Do some positive reframing instead of focusing on this is the most awful thing. Look for the positive in it. How's that possible?
How's that possible, Michelle? I mean, you're dealing with it, such a devastating disease. How do you, as a rabbi, as the counselor, how do you turn that overwhelming sense of anger, loss, into something positive? Is it really possible to do that?
Like I said, for example, my dad would walk around. When my dad died, we had a memorial service at the assisted living place where they lived. And we were at that point, my mom and my siblings and I were just drained and exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the staff came flooding into this memorial service and told us how special he was and how sweet he was and how kind he was. And he loved to joke. And he would, like I said, walk around singing or wheel around. He's in a wheelchair. Que sera, sera. So that was something that if we had paid more attention to, we would have noticed he was content. You know, there is a point, and my mother was at that point now. It took a long time to get there. There's a point where the behavior and the anger and paranoia and all that eventually melds into just contentment for an Alzheimer's client. And even though they need more care, you can see that they may be more at peace.
Really?
So it's fine. It's fine. Yeah, it's fine in the little things. You know, what was something your loved one did yesterday that was sort of funny or showed that they, and my father would reach out and hold my mother's hand.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really trying to focus on those little things that we tend to overlook when we're so focused on the difficult things.
Do you deal with anticipatory grief a lot in your counseling situations?
Yeah, it's because you know that eventually they're going to die. You know that they're going to get worse and worse and worse. I think it's not that eventually going to die as much as you're getting worse and worse and worse. You keep anticipating, you know, when is it going to happen? How much worse is it going to get? And you focus on that. It becomes part of your thought process.
And again,
it's very different than other diseases. Usually with other terminal diseases is a much better description of how it's going to progress. So you have an idea of what the turning points will be. And Alzheimer's is just much harder to pinpoint.
Yeah, and imagine as we learn that this is a very personal journey. I would imagine that everybody walks this walk very, very differently. In many cases, maybe depending upon how they live their life, some of that, you know, internal genetic DNA comes to the fore even in the throes of this disease. We're speaking with Rabbi Michelle. Whoops, go ahead.
No, do I have a minute? One of the interesting things I really discovered, personality changes. For people, I didn't do careful research, but for people who tend to keep things in before Alzheimer's hits, they start getting angry and frustrated. For people, and their personality gets mean and nasty. For people who were always worried and anxious and worried about the problems of the world and all that, they tend to get more mellow. So there were some adult children that, especially men, who really cherished their fathers with Alzheimer's because when they were younger, their father was critical and mean and strict and all that. Now in the Alzheimer's stage, they were cherishing that relationship that they had. But it was really interesting. The personality changes are not always for the worse.
That's a great point, because I think there's some people who really, you know, see other people and the negativity, but people who work with this population and the caregivers, as you do, as some of our other colleagues do, you know, that possibility for the cherishness, if that's a word, quotient that you talk about. And there's a great possibility of spiritual growth also in this bonding that takes place in, because it's very private. The caregiving can sometimes be extremely private and issues come up and sometimes past issues and get resolved and are reconciled in ways that perhaps people didn't even realize that were possible. As you're talking about and as you write in the book, especially with that hope section, of being open to these possibilities really can help guide the process. We're speaking with Rabbi Michelle Medwin, whose new book, Alzheimer's Families, Emotional and Spiritual Tools for Coping, just published, available on at The Great God at Amazon. To close this segment out, Michelle, and I appreciate it, and I appreciate you talking with us, you know, not with your voice not feeling so well. This caregiver's prayer, did you write this caregiver's prayer? It's in the back of the book in one of your appendixes. Or did you get this from something you remember?
No. No, I've gotten them from different places.
This is a great prayer. We may actually put this on the website based upon this. And because the caregiver component of this is so powerful. And in the appendix on some of the ritual and liturgy, Rabbi Medwin includes this prayer. It's a good way to close this segment. Sustainer of the universe, help me to care for my loved one with hope, courage, and sensitivity. Grant me insight, resourcefulness, and the ability to ask for help and to accept help when it is needed. That's a great line. May I find the patience to overcome difficult moments and to find meaning and purpose in the smallest task. O eternal God, help me to remember to take care of myself so that I may have the strength to help others. Be with me and my loved one as we journey on this path together. May the one who makes peace in the heavens bring peace to me, to my family and loved ones, and to us all. Amen. Michelle, great prayer to include upon in this very, very handy book, easy to get through, chock full of very, very important tips and reflections. Thank you very much. Again, the book, Alzheimer's Families, Emotional and Spiritual Tools for Coping, Rabbi Michelle Medwin, on Amazon. Michelle, thank you. Take care. Feel better, please. Refuah Shlema. Try some honey in the tea.
I have it right now. Tea and honey. I'm drinking it as we talk.
Very, very good. Take care. Say hello to the family and just feel better. Thank you very much for everything.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back with our second guest and change tactics a little bit right after this message.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Welcome back to today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio and Podcast. Again, you can offer comments and suggestions on the Facebook page of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio or Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. On the voicemail little click on doohickey, which is a very technical comment, on the website on our homepage at jewishsacredaging.com. For our second segment today, we're going to change gears a little bit, and we welcome from the beautiful state of Florida, Gloria and David Goldfaden. Gloria, David, are you there, I hope?
Yes, Richard, we're here.
Hey,
can you hear
how
me?
Are you? How is life in Florida?
We're
actually,
good.
Today the something came out in the sky up here in New Jersey. It was a big, there's a big thing in the sky that's bright. People don't know what it is. They keep looking at it. But I understand it lives a lot in Florida, where you are. I hope.
No. Here in Florida, we're under a thunderstorm right now. It's directly over our head. It's been raining all morning.
Okay,
it's gray,
then
we hope to brighten up the show.
So Gloria and David Goldfaden, Gloria has a tremendous amount of experience, was appointed to the Maryland Commission on Child Abuse and Neglect, is a former founder and executive director for a Maryland statewide advocacy program, continued this work in Florida dealing with protection of children. David is a retired English professor and also served on various child abuse prevention nonprofit boards. We're here to talk about something that I know very, very little about, but, and to be honest, in full disclosure, we Gloria and David and I have had this conversation a little bit and piqued my interest to getting them on the podcast. Somebody called a guardian ad litem volunteer, which both of them are, and could you just explain to me what this is and why there's such a need for this cause?
Oh, thank you. And Rabbi Richard, I'm especially glad that you're having us on now because April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. And when I was a statewide director for Child Abuse America, the national organization, this is a very important time for us to reflect on what we're doing to help prevent child abuse. And today we're going to talk to you about CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. And that is the name of an organization that was put together in 1982 to respond to the federal program to treat child abuse and neglect and to prevent it. And while it seems that CASA and the Guardian Ad Litem program, which we're a part of, that I'll explain, is after a child was abused, but it's important for us to realize that we want to prevent further abuse of the child and further neglect of the child. So in itself, it does a lot to prevent abuse and to stop the cycle of child abuse that can happen in families as well by providing and making sure that the child in each case is given a safe home and a safe environment to grow up, to be healthy and safe. The Guardian Ad Litem program, first of all, Guardian Ad Litem stands for the guardian in the law. And that particular type of office is sometimes not just children. It's other people who are incapacitated who cannot speak for themselves. Children have no voice in the court system, and so this gives them an opportunity to have a voice in the system as to what is in the best interest of the child. So that's who we are. We are court-appointed officials, and our mandate is to provide for the best interest of the child and to tell the courts and the other systems who have intervened in the child's life after abuse and neglect has happened, exactly what we think is the best advice for the child and the child's environment. These cases happen after the child is removed from both parents or one parent because there has been allegations of abuse and neglect. And in the case of the drug and opioid situation, many, many cases are coming on now that is actually taxing the system terribly because so many parents are having their children taken away from them because they are drug users and they're neglecting their kids. And usually the way this happens for us is that we have 30 hours of training and we have a criminal background check and then we have ongoing training. But David also is going to talk to you about how we do this together as well.
Well, let me interrupt here for a second just to make sure we understand. You volunteered. You live in Central Florida. You've both had a background in some of this work, especially you, Gloria. You volunteered to become a guardian ad litem. You went to training. And then do you then wait for the court to contact you saying, I have a case for you to be involved with? Or how does that connection work?
Well, the guardian office here in Florida, we're in Central Florida, is actually located in Ocala. We're near Orlando. It's the 5th District, and the office contacts us and tells us that they have a need for a guardian for a particular case, and each case is very different. So there are no cases that are alike. They all have their own particular identity. And we just seem to have fallen into cases where we are dealing with infant children under the age of 1 year.
Wow.
And that's basically been our specialty for the past 6 or 7 years. And I think we've probably gone through over a dozen cases.
David, how long does a typical case that you've been involved with, you've been doing this for several years, how long does a case last? And do you only handle one case at a time, or can you be involved with multiple cases at the same time?
Yes, Richard, we we do have multiple cases at the same time. We have as many as 3 or 4 cases at one time. Currently, we have 2, but we often serve as a volunteer for a different county where they have someone who has moved and they need someone to represent the office. So we may have as many as 3.
How long do these a typical case, if there is such a thing, but general ballpark, will this last 2 months? Will it last 8 months, a year?
Yeah, I would say that they can last longer than 2 years. For most of our cases are approximately 2 years. And you know, the court system, the wheels grind very slowly. And so we deal directly with the court, and we make appearances in the court to testify. And after we have investigated the case, we make recommendations directly to the judge. And we do this through our own attorney. In some states, guardians must be attorneys themselves. In Florida, however, we have this volunteer system. And the volunteer system seems to work very well because it attracts many of the best people, and the training is rigorous, and the training is ongoing. So I would say that, you know, basically we could expect to spend 2 years for each case.
And how do you – let me ask you, because a follow-up on what David just mentioned, that you investigate the case. And then you said a significant number of the cases that the two of you have been involved with were children under 1 year of age. Walk me through very quickly, how do you investigate this? Do you go interview the biological parent? Do you interview – How do you investigate the case in order to then make a judgment before the court?
Well, Richard, the first thing that happens, as David said, is that we are gotten in touch with and we say, okay, we'll take that case. And usually it is at the time of the birth of a baby. Literally in the hospital, the hospital staff does a test and finds out that mom is drug addicted and unfortunately the baby is drug addicted too. So most of our children, our infants we're dealing with are drug addicted themselves. And then the state comes in and removes the child from the parents. And then we are called in and we are told where the child is located. And in most cases, the child is located with a relative, and even more, most cases, with the grandparents. And we are given the grandparents' contact information, and then we go and visit the child and the grandparents a minimum of once a month. But when things first get started, we want to get to know them, so it's usually more often than that. And we stay an hour or two with the grandparents visiting the child, making sure the environment is safe where the child is placed, answering all of the questions about what might happen in the days to come.
Yeah, Richard, I can say that when we meet the biological parents, we often meet them in jail. They are usually incarcerated for drug addiction or other related crimes. And so very often, that's our first exposure to the parents. So we deal with both the parents and the caregivers. And recently, I'd say in the past 3 or 4 years, the caregivers are the grandparents.
Right.
So we have now a phenomenon of grandparents raising the children. And often they adopt the child. Right now, one of the cases that we've been involved with for probably a year and a half, the adoption process is ongoing. And so the grandparents are adopting the child because the parents have given up the rights. It's called termination of parental rights. And the court accepted their waiver of parental rights. And because they're still under the influence of drugs and they can't get out of it.
Another reason why we are often taking infant cases is because we know that in terms of child abuse and neglect, the fatalities happen most often when a child is under the age of five. And we want to be sure that those children are protected. Now, we are not the Department of Human Resources or Department of Social Services, whatever it may be called in your state. We are a separate entity. And so sometimes we're in court and we find ourselves disagreeing with the findings of the Department of Social Services, or sometimes we may be in agreement. But the Department of Social Services is also visiting the child and also laying out a family plan. And we sit in on those mediations with the parent to determine what is their plan to get their children back. Unfortunately, many times they do not follow their plan, which might mean parenting classes, drug tests, they fail the drug tests, court appearances, those kinds of things. And it is sometimes imperative for us to actually be the ones who take the stand and recommend that the child not be returned to the parents. And in Central Florida, I'm so pleased to say that the courts, the judges listen to us. They ask us last, well, what does the guardian have to say? And we testify. Once I was on the stand for 2.5 hours. And we testify about what we have seen and what we have heard and what the child is exposed to now and always how the child is doing. Maybe in daycare, medical reasons. We have access because we're court officials that we can take to any school and any doctor anytime and say we need to see the child immediately, and we give full access. So we have all of this to report. But part of the respect I think that the courts have is that because we're volunteers, we're not in anybody's agenda. We're not being paid by anyone. We are absolutely for the best interest of the child at all times.
So, Gloria, let me ask you a question, the two of you. You yourself, the two of you, deal, as you said, predominantly with infants, but this really is a concern, the guardian ad litem program. I think you alluded to at the beginning of the segment, not specifically just for infants, but for young people, kids, who may be dealing with abuse or neglect.
Yeah, that's so, anyone under the age of 18.
Actually, we have a 9-year-old boy as one of our cases right now as well. And one of our first cases were 2 teenage boys. So let me
before we start running out of time, how do you deal, because I would assume that not everything is just peaches and cream. How do you deal with some of the hostility when you walk into a home or have to deal with the biological parents or the caregivers, and there's a potential of that child being removed or, incarceration? How do you begin to deal with some of that hostility?
Well, one of the reasons we work as a team is because we do run into those problems quite often. In fact, our first case 8 years ago, we were assigned the case especially as a team because it was so high profile. It was, one of the worst cases of child abuse that we have ever heard of. And it just so happened to be a 4-month-old child. And we really had serious problems dealing with every aspect of this case. And it finally went to trial, and the court decided that the chain of events dealing with the child's injuries could not be determined. And therefore, the judge could not make a ruling, but he did say that he held the parents responsible.
Yeah. So, in that case, sometimes the grandparents who have care of the children are in denial also that their own children could have committed these acts, in that case, five broken bones of a four-month-old, could have committed these acts to their own grandchild. So they fight, too, with the system trying to say and resist. They want to have it proven that their own children could never have done this to their grandchildren. And so that does happen.
Well, also, because there are two of us, and, you know, I can relate to the grandfather or the, you know, the putative biological father. In some cases, we don't even know who the biological father really is.
Correct.
In Florida, a child is born, and the person who puts his name on the birth certificate is considered the father.
Right.
Even though he may not be the biological father. So there are many, many, many intricacies involved, and each case is so different, Richard. It's often a conundrum.
How do you deal with because the emotional baggage of all these cases can, I imagine, over the course of time, just mount up. How do you begin to deal with just the emotional struggle, the emotional challenges, and perhaps the emotional burnout of just dealing with so much?
Well, I think there are a few good reasons. One is that we approach this, as I told you from the beginning of this interview, we approach it from prevention. We are there to make sure this child is never harmed again. Also, we get pretty close to the children when we visit them, and we feel so warm and pleased when we see their faces and see that we're helping to keep them in a good environment. And so we approach it from a very, very positive way.
You've had so much experience. Laura's had almost 20 years of experience with these cases.
30.
Okay, well.
Who's counting?
Yeah,
but the emotional, the emotional baggage of this, I mean, do volunteers burn out a lot because it's just too much?
No, Richard, I don't really think so. I think there's as much as volunteers put into each case, they get a lot out of the cases too. There's an awful lot of interaction and really a lot of love. And we've met quite a few guardians, and really their interest and their level of responsibility is so high. It really is amazing how many quality people are attracted to the guardian program.
And, you know, we're all child advocates, and across the nation, there are 87,000 CASA and guardian ad litem volunteers. They go by either one of those names. And that means that they're serving over 280,000 children, but unfortunately there are still over 400,000 children who are on a waiting list waiting for a guardian. So the need for more volunteers is so important. And when you see the babies, and as they're growing up and being 1 and 2 years old, it is such a wonderful thing to see them smiling and being healthy and away from danger. So the rewards are so much higher than what we have to actually do ourselves. But we do have to write reports for the court. And by the way, you do not have to have any special background at all. There are people who are engineers and people who are teachers and secretaries and in their capacity in the business world. Just because it happens that we have came to it with a good bit of experience, that is not the case usually at all. You just have to want to be a child advocate.
Okay, so this program, the Guardian Ad Litem program, from what I'm hearing you say, exists in all the states? I mean, if somebody is sitting in Montana and wants to, this is something that really appeals to them, in every state?
Yes, definitely. It's been 49 states. I'm not sure which one is the one that it's not in, and I think it's being worked on. And if people want to go to www.casaforchildren.org, that's C-A-S, as in Sam, A, forchildren.org, they can actually put in their zip code, and it'll bring up all the offices, excuse me, where the guardian ad litem offices are, and they can get in touch with them that way. And just, it's just good to have information and think about it at least. It's so rewarding.
So that's C-A-S-A, is it the word for F-O-R or the number four?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's the word for C-A-S-A-F-O-R children.org.
And that will connect somebody to local,
right,
you know, how to do it locally in each state.
To, yeah, if they put in their zip code, it'll connect them to the state and local guardian program.
Great. So, listen, we're starting to run out of time on this segment. Have you ever bumped into or followed up after a case is closed with a kid 2 or 3 years later to just are you allowed to do that, or once the case closes,
is
over?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Some guardians talk about how they went to their children's, you know, high school graduation. But we have noticed that in a few cases, the grandparents reach out to us. They want to keep in touch with us. They want to, you know, hear about how we're doing and tell how the little one is doing, and they send us pictures. And, yes, definitely. And that's a wonderful thing to see a child progressing so well.
Yeah. And Gloria has developed such a connection with some that they call her the guardian angel.
Well, somehow I'm not surprised. listen, a couple just real fast too. This would seem to be, because this is a program that really also talks, you know, focuses a lot on baby boomers and our families, but this would seem to be something very, very appealing to boomers who perhaps have left full-time work. Do you see a representation of our age group within the volunteer programs that you work with?
Yes, absolutely. Although it does, there are younger guardian volunteers, when I mean younger, in their 30s and 40s, but
right.
mainly it attracts people of our age, retired, you know, especially here in Florida, people from all backgrounds, and usually we're not so unusual, because many of the volunteers, husbands and wives, get involved, because we've met quite a few.
We've been speaking with Gloria Goldfaden and David Goldfaden, talking about their work, this unbelievably challenging but very rewarding work and needed work as a guardian ad litem volunteer with children at risk, abused children. The court-appointed special advocates program. Again, that website to check it out in your local area is casaforchildren.org. casaforchildren.org. Gloria and David, thank you very, very much for giving us your time, this expertise. Continued good luck. This is an amazing program, and congratulations on all the great work that you're doing. Hope to hear from you soon. Just take care. Take care of yourself.
Thank you, Richard. We hope to see you soon.
Hope so, too.
Thank you, Rabbi Richard.
Take care. Take care, Rabbi Gloria.
Okay.
Thank you, all of you, for being part of today's broadcast of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio and podcast. These shows are archived as podcasts on both Blog Talk Radio and especially on our website, JewishSacredAging.com. And again, we invite your comments and suggestions to rabbi@JewishSacredAging.com or on our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. These shows are produced at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media in beautiful Cherry Hill, New Jersey, under the control of our producer, Steve Lubetkin. We thank you for listening, and we look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio podcast. Thank you again for listening. Have a great week. I'm your host, Richard Address. Thank you, and shalom.